Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Lucas Davis, your moderator. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. Thomas Isaacs serves as the director for the Office of Planning and Special Studies at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He's currently on sabbatical at Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation, focusing his research on challenges to the effective management of the global expansion of nuclear energy. Isaacs' career spans more than two decades with the Department of Energy, including managing policies and programs on the advancement of nuclear power and issues associated with security, waste management, and public trust. Per Peterson is a professor and chair of the Department of Nuclear Engineering at UC Berkeley. He has worked on problems in energy and environmental systems, including advanced light water reactors, high-temperature reactors, high-level nuclear waste processing, and nuclear materials management. In February 2010, he was appointed as a member of the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future. And John White is the executive director of the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies, known as CEERT, which is a partnership of major environmental groups and private sector clean energy companies that design and fight for policies that promote global warming solutions and an increased reliance on clean, renewable energy sources for California and the West. Before founding CEERT, White served as a senior policy consultant for 9 years on the staff of the California Assembly. So please join me in welcoming Thomas Isaacs, Per Peterson, and John White. The topic for this evening is Powering America. Does nuclear power have a future? We're going to start with Per Peterson. So nuclear has been on everyone's minds here recently, and we know that in March 2011, an earthquake and tsunami knocked out power at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in northern Japan, causing partial meltdowns at the plant's three active reactors and a large-scale release of radioactive steam. During the crisis, it seems like we heard everything, from that this is going to have no effect on U.S. nuclear power, that this is going to effectively put an end to discussion of all of this U.S. nuclear renaissance, some people were calling it. Now that a bit more time has passed and better information is available, it seems like a good chance to reflect on what we've learned so far. So, Per, what safety lessons have been learned from the disaster at Fukushima, and how do they relate to current and future U.S. facilities?
Thank you, Lucas. Let me spend a few minutes to address that question. The thing about the Fukushima accident that makes it unique is that it's the first large-scale major reactor accident we've had in the world that was not initiated by some combination of equipment failures and human errors, as was the case with TMI and with Chernobyl. So instead, it was initiated by an extraordinarily destructive external event, which caused extensive damage to the plant. Many of the plant personnel left immediately after the earthquake to go find their families. After the tsunami arrived, they had a struggle to get back. So the nature of the accident is different from what we've encountered before. And this means that there will be a number of lessons that will need to be learned from this accident that will feed into improving the future safety of nuclear power plants. If we go back to the TMI accident, what we've seen post-TMI are systematic efforts to reduce the frequency of equipment failures and human errors. In terms of the statistics for the rates of those things, they've declined by over an order of magnitude, which suggests that their safety of plants with respect to internally initiated accidents is now substantially better than it was pre-TMI. But in the case of large external events like earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, hurricanes, and the like, what we're learning from Fukushima is that preparation for these types of events is a very important thing to have done. So in terms of specific lessons, one of the things that we need to study and learn more about, and already there's information coming out, is what was the combination of problems with the physical damage to the plant, the pre-deployment of portable equipment, the severe accident management guidelines that are in place, which in Japan actually had not been updated since 1992, and the decision-making process that led to substantial delays in the action to begin the injection of seawater and therefore prevent damage to fuel and the progression of the accident. Another important set of questions relates to what the pathways were by which hydrogen that was released from the damaged fuel made its way into the secondary containments of four of the reactors and caused explosions, which caused extensive structural damage and aggravated further the response to the accident. Also, there's some questions related to the adequacy of the instrumentation that was available to monitor the state of the plant, in particular things such as the water level in the spent fuel pools, which of course in the course of an accident like this is something that's important to know about. And in fact, the capability to measure those water levels was not available, which made the decision-making process more complicated going forward. And then the final point is that there are lessons to be learned about how the radioactive materials were released, because in fact the vast majority of the fission products that were released from the damaged fuel were retained inside the containment. In fact, one of the greatest challenges the Japanese face now in cleaning up the site is related to the large volumes of highly contaminated water that are in these reactors that they're now attempting to stand up treatment capability. We have extensive experience with treating these types of fluids in the United States from cleaning up waste tanks that were used in the weapons programs. But in some sense, that's a great problem to have, because in the case of Chernobyl, all of those materials were simply released out into the environment. And at least here, they were retained on site. So that said, there's a number of things that we should be looking at in terms of lessons for existing plants, and then also for new plants that might be built in the future. The first is that already the utilities are going back and reviewing procedures that were put in place after 9/11 due to concerns that you could have airplanes crashed in the nuclear power plants. And the impact of having large explosions or large fires that would result from such a crash could be similar in some sense to the type of impact that occurred from this tsunami. And so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission required plants to develop the capability to hook up portable equipment to inject water into reactors, to have that equipment on site, to have procedures and training for using it. Unfortunately, similar capability was not implemented in Japan, and this is one of the reasons why the processes to get water injected into the reactors took so much longer. But there's a process underway right now by which they're reviewing the adequacy of these procedures, given the fact that this is now a much more realistic and believable event, and therefore we want to make sure that those capabilities are in place and that they would be able to be exercised in a timely way. So that's, I think, one of the most important set of lessons, but there will be additional lessons as well. In particular, there's certainly going to be a review of practices for the storage of spent fuel and the racking of spent fuel in spent fuel pools. With respect to the new plant designs, one of the best things that we can do is to move away from systems for decay heat removal after you shut down reactors that require electrical power and that require an external heat sink. And the passive reactor designs, which have been developed and licensed in the United States, in fact, the plants which are most likely to be built in the near term in South Carolina and Georgia, use these passive safety systems. And therefore, when you shut them down, there's no need for power. There's no need for water injection. You actually remove heat ultimately just to air that circulates through and over the containment building. So that would probably be some of the more important lessons related to the new plant designs. I think that for us to get to the point of having a clear understanding of all of the things that need to change will take some time, but that the early lessons in particular are going to relate to making sure that the preparations are in place and that decision-making processes for implementing what the NRC calls their extensive damage mitigation guidelines would be effective in the event that you were to have a similar type of extreme external event that would cause substantial damage to installed plant systems, to destroy systems that might provide electrical power and cooling, and to be able to connect portable equipment and restore those functions before you have fuel damage, release of radioactive material, and the potential for the substantive off-site consequences that have been caused by the Fukushima accident. That's about
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Per.
Good.
So, okay, let's bring in Thomas Isaacs and continue to broaden the discussion a bit beyond safety. This has been a tumultuous couple of years in the U.S. nuclear power sector. 2007-2008 was significant because the NRC received license applications for 27 new reactors. This was a big deal. because these were the first reactors that would be built in the U.S. in 3 decades. Some went so far during that period to say that we were in the midst of a nuclear renaissance, while others were not so sure, pointing to high capital costs and other challenges that the U.S. nuclear industry continues to face. So, Tom, give us a little context here. How can you please tell us what you see as the largest hurdles in terms of policy, financing, and storage facing the expansion of nuclear energy in the U.S. and internationally?
Thank you very much. When we talk about the future of nuclear power, and it's been this way all along, there's usually 4 issues that people tend to focus on. One is the safety of the technology. The second is it economical? Is it something that will stand its place in the marketplace? The third is, what are you going to do with the nuclear waste, which is an issue that continues to be challenging and is not yet resolved. And the fourth is the concerns about proliferation. The same technologies and materials that are used for nuclear reactors can be misused in ways to further nuclear weapons programs, and that's been a concern from the beginning. I would add to those 4 2 other issues that I'll talk about very briefly as well. One is finance. It's one thing to say that a technology is economical, but these plants are very expensive to build, and they take a long time to build, and you have to run them for very long times to recoup your investment. So you have to look at the possibilities of financing the construction of these plants. They're expensive to build, relatively cheap to run, but getting that money will not be easy. And the other factor, which has now been exacerbated, I would say, by Fukushima, but it's there always anyway, are issues with regard to political and particularly public acceptance. We know that this technology tends to be highly controversial in lots of different places. So let me talk about 4 points quickly, if I might. The first is, it's really difficult to know what's going to happen. It's very difficult to predict. In the early days of nuclear power, in what I called the romantic stage, people thought that nuclear power was going to solve our electricity problems and that it would become very quickly the predominant form of electrical production in this country. And when I started my career, the general projections were that we would have about 1,000 commercial-sized nuclear power plants in this country by the year 2000. And we were off by an order of magnitude. We have about 100. That's not bad. That is quite an accomplishment, but nowhere near what people had projected. So we were overly optimistic in this romantic stage. Nonetheless, it's important to recognize that about 20% of our electricity in this country comes from baseload nuclear power today. And if we have about 300 million people or so, benchmark, nuclear power is providing all the electrical needs of the equivalent of 60 million people consuming electricity at U.S. standards. So that's pretty significant in a relatively short period of time. Also, we had a period of time in the 80s and 90s when just the opposite seemed to be there, that people thought we were going to see the demise of nuclear power, that these plants had been licensed for 40 years, they were going to come to the end of their operating licensing time, we weren't building more nuclear power plants, and we would simply shut those plants down, and nuclear power would gracefully go away, and that was wrong too. So we were overly pessimistic, and what happened there was a consolidation in the industry. Companies bought power plants at relatively cheap prices. They went into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and said, we want to provide you with information that we allow us to run these plants not for 40 years but for 60 years. NRC has been providing license extensions for most of these plants. Most of these plants now are going in for lifetime extensions. And in some senses, these plants are now cash cows. Once they've been built, they run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They provide reliable energy. Their performance has gone from sort of okay to really superb over the last 20 or 30 years. And so nuclear power plants that we have today are likely to be there for some period of time. But I hasten to tell you that we should take this lesson to heart, that we've been wrong on the positive side, the romantic, the optimistic side, and we've been wrong on the negative side, and we will learn more, and we need to understand that we will be surprised in the future no matter what we think today. Paper exercises, and small-scale demonstrations are important, but they shouldn't cause us to have over-optimism about what the future is going to bring. So that's my first point. Second point, my own experience in this industry is that nuclear power is something like the equivalent of a Rorschach test. People's views on nuclear power are informed by, most cases, things not just to do with the technology itself, but a broader vision of sorts of how nuclear power became aware in the world. The fact that we learned about nuclear power when weapons were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example. The fact that people tend to think of nuclear power as the embodiment of technology, the future, advancement, but also big business, big government. So people bring to their value system, I believe, more in many cases, including me and others, when they talk about is nuclear power something that should be part of our future? How should we feel about that technology? Internationally, many countries view nuclear power as a shortcut to international credibility and status. They see this as a way, it's like when a country, you know, maybe not so rich, but wants to have its own airline, and they go to a U.S. company and they get planes and they get trained pilots and they put their country's insignia on the tail, and all of a sudden they've got an airline, and that raises their status. And nuclear power in many countries' minds is very much the same thing. So even if it isn't economical, in many cases countries want to have nuclear power, particularly in cases where some countries have internal regime problems. They see nuclear power as one of a handful of tools they can use to raise their status and quell internal problems as well. So there's lots of baggage, if you will, both positive and negative, that attends to one's views on nuclear power. And I think it pays all of us to sort of look inside of ourselves as we think about this technology and whether or not we think it's, quote, good or bad, or it's something we ought to have, or it's something we ought to try and get rid of. I think it's a much, much more complicated issue. So where are we going to go in the United States with regard to nuclear power? And I'll talk about the impact of Fukushima here in just a second. One, I think we're going to have mostly coal and gas new production for some period of time. I think the current fleet of nuclear power plants, we will have a pause. We will look very carefully at the lessons to be learned from Fukushima. We should be in a constant lessons learned mode anyway in nuclear power and every other advanced technology. We should not be satisfied with the technology. We should all be striving to learn lessons. And so we will have lots of coal and the climate problems that are attendant to it. We will have lots of natural gas. And as you know, we're finding lots of natural gas now. And in some senses, maybe we're back in a romantic stage, but we're already starting to see what? We're starting to see concerns about fracking and whether or not there are environmental impacts of going to large enhancements of our use of natural gas. So I think we have to be very, very careful about drawing short-term conclusions for long-term gains. Nuclear power plants are very expensive. We haven't built one in this country in about 30 years. So what it's going to cost has a large degree of uncertainty with it, but it's probably $5 to $7 billion would not be a bad guess, although Pear might have a better number. But with those kind of numbers, you're unlikely to have utilities in this country betting their future, because this is a lot of money on a successful siting, licensing, and operation of a nuclear power plant without some kind of guarantee. And there are discussions and programs inside the government to provide loan guarantees, to underwrite these plants, to provide the kind of assurance necessary for a utility to be willing to undertake this. We're probably not going to have large numbers of nuclear power plants in this country in the short term. In the long term, I think we'll have to wait and see what happens. What do we need? You asked the question about what do we need in the way of policies. What we really need is a policy. We need a policy that's clear, and it's got to be stable, and it's got to be compelling. And we've had a lot of trouble in this country. And if you're a utility CEO, you're going to be very careful. They're conservative by nature anyway. That's what they should be. They're going to be very careful about marching into a situation in which policies and regulations and the terrain of which they have to operate for these very large, complex, costly, time-consuming technologies are going to go into a framework where they don't know what the policies are going to be. Is there going to be a carbon tax or the equivalent of a carbon tax? If there was a carbon tax of certain sizes implemented tomorrow, that would change the entire outlook for nuclear power in a heartbeat. And we don't know what's going to happen there. In the short term, we know, but in the longer term, we'll see what happens. So I think that in terms of Fukushima, I don't think personally it's going to have a dramatic effect, because I don't think we were going to see in the short term a large return in this country to nuclear power anyway. Where it's going to have an effect is on issues of trust and confidence. And that's at the heart of what we have to do here in the long term if we're going to be successful, is we've got to come up with a practical way of demonstrating things to public, to the politicians, so that we can earn trust and confidence in that business to the extent that it's deserved and decisions can be made. Waste management remains a conundrum. Pear mentioned that he's on the Blue Ribbon Commission. I'm an advisor to that commission. We still don't have a permanent repository for the disposition of the high-level waste. That waste is hazardous for very long periods of time, so it needs permanent disposal. There's a general consensus that putting it deep in stable underground geologic formations is a fine solution. It's been the preferred option for every country who's serious about this for over 50 years now. But politically, it's very, very difficult to do. And demonstrating to a skeptical public and skeptical regulator that this thing is going to work for hundreds of thousands of years is also a major scientific and technical challenge. So we will continue to work on that, and we need a vibrant and credible repository program, and we will need storage for decades under any circumstances in the meantime. On the international side, there's 30 or 31 countries today who have operating nuclear power plants. A small number of those plants, as a result of Fukushima or Fukushima plus other events, may indeed gracefully exit the stage. You know, countries like Germany, Switzerland, Japan have talked about removing it. I would be careful about that as well. We've seen countries claim this also in the past and come to realize that they don't have an option, that they need nuclear power as part of their baseload for the future, and they have come back to considering it. We also see countries saying we're not going to have nuclear power, and then they import nuclear electricity from other countries who are generated from nuclear power plants as if somehow those electrons, you know, are cleaned as they go across the national border there. We'll see. Now, some countries, I believe, will probably make a diplomatic pause while they look at the consequences here and then continue. In particular, China, India, South Korea are examples of the future of nuclear power. That's where the future is. It's in Asia. And if the United States doesn't come up with a robust, compelling program to engage the international community, it may be to our detriment, because the United States has always been a leader in concerns about safety and security and proliferation and environmental considerations. And if we're on the sideline, and we're moving to the sideline in many ways, we are going to have less and less influence to assure that as these countries expand and as more new countries start to think about nuclear power in a serious way, we won't have the kind of influence that I think we want to have to make sure that it's the kind of future for them that we would like to see. Bottom line, I think Fukushima was a disaster in many, many ways. As Per Petersen says, the health effects are still unknown. I think we're going to continue to learn and maybe be surprised about what's actually happened at Fukushima. We have a lot of technology yet to learn. We're learning lessons, as you heard. I think the health effects are unknown. At a National Academy of Science board meeting, which I sit on, we had a presentation recently about the effects from a professor at the University of Tokyo, and his view was that in addition to all the direct consequences there, that two things struck him as being outcomes of Fukushima that were of concern, and I think they're of concern here too. One is the loss of credibility in science and technology in general. And that can be very disconcerting, I think, for all of us, because we need to underpin the future with credible and vibrant science and technology. And the other is the loss of confidence in energy scholars and students. When nuclear power went through its ebb 20 years or so ago, we lost about half our nuclear engineering programs in this country. We lost about half our nuclear reactors. Folks, it's going to be a nuclear world. Independent of whether you are pro-nuclear, anti-nuclear, or agnostic, we will have things nuclear for decades and generations. And we need to have the technology and the expertise to deal with that uncertain world. In my mind, the virtue is to provide flexibility and adaptability for an uncertain and often surprising world. And we need to have that expertise and that engagement in order to make that happen. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Tom. Let's bring John White in, and let's broaden the discussion even further now to think about other forms of electricity generation, maybe even bring in other forms of energy. So forecasts of U.S. energy consumption, it's pretty surprising, actually, but our electricity demand has actually gone down for the last 2 years, slightly, but actually gone down. Nonetheless, if you look at the Department of Energy's annual energy outlook, they forecast that by 2035, we're going to be at a 30% increase in energy, a 22% increase in electricity. A recent study by the Brattle Group reports that to meet this increased demand is going to require a $2.5 billion investment in new generation and infrastructure. Meeting this increased demand at reasonable cost without a substantial increase in carbon dioxide emissions is a giant challenge. John, what can we do? What other green technologies, aside from nuclear, do you see as being capable of fueling America's energy needs now and in the future? And what might we expect?
Thank you. The first place to look for green energy is in our buildings, in our homes, where we waste an enormous amount of energy that is simply simple to capture. There is significant variation in what existing buildings and existing homes are capable of doing with relatively modest changes. And this is very overlooked. The paybacks are relatively short term, but it's basically we're content to continue as we are. And so we have to look first to the buildings in our homes where we can just do an enormous amount, even with increased energy utilization in all the parts of the economy. The second place that we look is to renewable resources, which in California's case we have an abundance, and but which are vary around the country in terms of what resources are there and what their quality is. The one technology that is probably universal among the renewables is biomethane from wastewater treatment plants, from animal waste, from dairies and the like. In California, again, we have a substantial amount of biomethane that is generated and currently not converted. Some of it is flared through landfills. Some of it is allowed to evaporate. And so capturing the methane that is coming from our waste products, food processors and so forth, we have technologies available and getting cheaper all the time that can convert those technologies to, in some cases, zero-emission electricity. If the one thing about this conversation I think we should be prepared to keep our eyes on is the Germans, the Swiss, and the Japanese, and these countries have made strategic decisions, at least in the case of the Germans, with a very conservative government to accelerate the planned retirement of their nuclear units. This is the principal political and economic fallout from the Japanese meltdown, and I think that their response will teach us more about the alternatives. The Germans and the other some of the other Europeans have done some very innovative financing mechanisms for renewable energy. The so-called feed-in tariff has made a very substantial impact on the German power system in terms of the incentive that's created for individual homeowners and farmers and buildings to produce on-site renewable energy for export to the grid. Ironically, Germany has very poor solar radiation compared to California and compared to many parts of the U.S., but they've made the investment nonetheless because of the global economic opportunities that they see for their engineering and financial firms. So the Germans have made a decision, and I think that's partly what has given them the confidence to set aside their dependence on nuclear power. In the western U.S., we have abundant solar resources, and we have technologies that are moving forward today with available subsidies and programs to support them. Ironically, when we talk about nuclear power, I think as I was sitting here thinking about it, this technology is virtually uninsurable. It is virtually unfinanceable without extraordinary guarantees from somebody, a sovereign government in some cases, or the ratepayers in the utilities case. A blank check is what's required, basically, to finance these projects. And it's very unforgiving in terms of the consequences of even a low-probability event. And so when we judge the cost and availability of alternatives, we need to keep that fact in mind. I think that we can point to the downside and the difficulty of all of these alternative resources. Solar doesn't produce energy all the time, although there are technologies, solar thermal, concentrating solar, that can produce energy over the vast majority of the day and can have energy stored with molten salt technology into the nighttime hours. So you can fit the largest part of your load in the West, which is air conditioning, nicely with the solar resource. Wind is also variable, but comes at different times. And in some places like Wyoming and Montana, you have very, very high capacity factors, which means the wind blows a lot and it blows heavy. But we also got new technologies in wind turbines that can take advantage of lower speed wind resources with new technology that has enabled you to get more electricity out of a given amount of wind. All of the renewable technologies have siting issues and environmental consequences. And in some cases, areas are not appropriate for development. One of the conversation that's going on in the West is we need to identify areas that are best for renewable development and preserve those areas that are not, that either have high value for species and land conservation, wilderness, wildlife habitat. On the other hand, in the California desert, we've made more land available for off-road vehicle recreation than we have for solar. So we need to redress that imbalance and get the solar into the mix. We also have large military reservations in the West that can also be home to some of these technologies. And in fact, the military planners are looking at renewable technology as a way to increase the reliability of electric production for military installations. And so I think as we look out to the future, we will see a partnership between a lot of different people to try to make these technologies come to life, because they offer so many advantages in terms of reduction of risk and in terms of economic development. I think there is a new sense of momentum behind these technologies, although they remain difficult to finance, because unlike the nuclear industry and the oil and gas industry, the magnitude of the subsidies available are much smaller. And you know, the incumbent generators have many of the economic advantages, and it's the new entrants that are having difficulties. And the financial crisis has exacerbated that difficulty because the banks have less money to lend, and these technologies are in some cases not demonstrated at scale to be able to inspire the confidence of the banker. On the other hand, the Obama administration and the Congress included in the stimulus package some very significant financial mechanisms. One is the Treasury cash grant, which replaces the tax equity financing that is typically a major part of building a renewable project. So that cash grant is available to projects that are permitted and under construction by the end of this year. The second program, similar to one that was mentioned for nuclear, is the Department of Energy Loan Guarantee. That program goes through the end of 2012. So there is currently a revival of renewable energy in California and the West. We are seeing several thousand megawatts of projects being permitted, and we hope that will be financed. There's also issues that need to be resolved and that have been typically cited as a barrier to alternative renewable technologies, and that's the difficulty of building transmission lines. I will say that at least in California, we have overcome some of those difficulties sufficiently enough to have put in place some new lines that are bringing power from the wind resource in Kern County into Southern California. Another proposal, much more controversial, to build from Imperial into San Diego. That project was partly impeded because the utility didn't listen to the advice they got, and they tried to build it through a state park. And you cannot be surprised that if you try to build a transmission line through a state park, it's going to take longer than if you find another route. So it took them a while to figure that out, but they did. And so these things are coming together, and I think we will see a new generation of a fleet of renewable projects that will create some sense of possibility here. Geothermal is another technology that's a baseload technology, runs all the time, doesn't exist everywhere, but low temperature and medium temperature geothermal offers significant potential to add to the mix. So we're building, I think, potentially a new kind of electricity orchestra And that orchestra will have different pieces, and they're going to have to play together and be coordinated together with a conductor and with technology. The other part of the mix is the distributed resources. Rooftop solar has undergone a revival in California to match the revival in Japan and Germany. The costs are falling rapidly for solar photovoltaics on rooftops and on warehouses and other large kinds of places in near substations. So solar is getting cheaper, and it can be put on near the load, so it can minimize the use of transmission. We can also have fuel cells running on animal waste. We can also have storage and a variety of other kinds of smart grid technologies that will enable us to be more mobile as when we get signals that the shortages are potentially around the corner, then we can have buildings drop their load and customers maybe cut back on the air conditioning. These are all things that are going to take coordination and cooperation, and they're not easy. But compared to the problems of the alternative, they're necessary. And I think we have an opportunity to create a new kind of economic paradigm with our country not just becoming an importer of technologies from Germany and from Japan and from China, but to be a large enough market that we start to create wealth and create technology here. These projects that I mentioned that are being built through the permitting process and through the incentive programs currently available in California are generating supply chain activity. They're generating people to provide the glass and the steel in addition to the construction and the installation. And so when you start having green technology be what puts construction workers in Southern California back to work because they no longer can build houses because the economy has gone so flat, I think there's a stimulative opportunity that will broaden public understanding and support, and I think allow us to have a better conversation about the availability of the alternative. Now, not every part of the country is as blessed as we are. I don't know as much about as these gentlemen about the long-term future. I do know that if we can put 33% renewables in the California grid, which is going to happen partly because of legislation recently passed by Senator Joe Simidian and signed by Governor Brown, we achieve 33% renewables by 2020. That will be a signal to the rest of the country that we can do a lot with these technologies, and we hope that as this conversation evolves and we develop a portfolio of technologies to meet our national goals, and I very much agree with the need for a national policy and for sustained commitment to infrastructure, we think that the technologies that I've mentioned will play a very significant role and will enable us to reduce our risk and our reliance on some of the more unforgiving technologies, even as we continue to work and have research and to provide leadership to the global conversation on these technologies.
Terrific. Thanks. So great, great. I feel like we're so lucky to have this great panel today, and we have them for a few more minutes, so let's take advantage and hit them with these audience questions. There are a lot of great questions. I'm going to start with a number of questions, a couple questions about accidents, then turn to the fuel cycle, uranium, fuel storage. Then we'll talk about U.S. nuclear policy and finish talking about energy alternatives, so kind of the same format we took to begin with. But so let's start with accidents. Question, each time there's a nuclear incident, nuclear power supporters tell us why it's not really a problem or a problem that has just been solved. Why should we believe that it will always be safe? I think this is related to a question. Given our revenue challenges, does the government have the will to monitor and enforce compliance with safety regulations for nuclear power plants? So I guess what are the advantages and disadvantages or limitations of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and how we have it set up in the U.S.?
Well, maybe I'll go ahead and dive in on this question. The question of what constitutes acceptable safety for nuclear plants, what we've seen with Fukushima is a infrequent accident. It tends to be, it's focused in space and in time, And in that sense, it has some comparable attributes to when we have airplane crashes as well, which also tend to be infrequent, focused in space, focused in time, and therefore we look at them differently against the background of hazards associated with transportation. So one of the key questions that we face in thinking about safety is how do we compare different technologies. It turns out that one of the best tools is life cycle assessment. It's a fairly rigorous way to try to quantitatively add together all of these different factors, harm to public health, public safety, workers, environmental impacts. And in general, when these studies are done, for example, a very good study was done, the Externe study in the European Union, what you find is that the fossil fuels have very large external costs associated with public health, environmental impacts. We are looking at the potential for catastrophic changes to global climate in the coming century, and these external costs end up being in the range of 5 to 6 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour for coal. So if you take that with just multiply by global coal consumption, you come to the conclusion that these external costs are on the order of $1 trillion to $2 trillion per year. The Fukushima accident, if you add up all of the relocation costs and other things, may be in the range of $50 to $150 billion. So it falls into the category of very noticeable, but actually surprisingly moderate compared to the sustained set of problems that we have. And in fact, that does cause one to come back and ask the question, in Germany, was it a wise decision to shut down nuclear plants when 50% of their power generation comes from coal, and we know is certainly killing people going forward? Is that really an informed decision to take? And I think that if you looked at it in a quantitative way, you might reach the conclusion that it would be better off if they shut down their coal plants first and then focused on shutting down older nuclear plants and then build new nuclear plants if you can demonstrate that they actually are acceptable.
Can I add a point on that one? Because I want to add something in a slightly broader context. I think it's a legitimate question, this question of trust, which I mentioned in my early remarks. Why do you trust somebody? That's a question that I struggle with and quite a bit in my career. You know, I got on an airplane today and put my life in the hands of a whole bunch of people that I never met, and I certainly don't understand the technology. Why did I do that? I imagine most of you also fly from time to time and do other things where we put our lives in the hands of people that we never met. And we don't do it because the pilot stands there and says, let me show you how this plane works and how all this technology is there. Well, so why do we trust people? I think we trust people or institutions largely for three reasons. And you have to earn that trust by demonstrating. The first one is you have to believe that they are competent in what they're supposed to be doing and they have a track record of competence. You're unlikely to get on that airplane if, as you're walking on there, the pilot says, boy, am I excited. I've never flown one of these before. You know, you want to know that that pilot has flown that airplane for a long time and successfully. The second one is you want to believe that when people make decisions, they have your interests at heart. They have your well-being at heart. You may not know how that plane flies, but you surely want to know that that pilot or the person who's going to operate on your child or anyone else has your, when they're making decisions, they're making decisions with your best interests at heart. And the third reason that lends itself to trust is to respond to people's concerns. Don't say, I'm a scientist, I know what I'm doing, just listen to me, you'll be fine. But to take to heart when people have issues. We talked about the sighting. John talked about the sighting across the national park and how that becomes much more difficult. That's not surprising. You have to engage people who are likely to be affected or think they're going to be affected and take their concerns seriously. So I think when we come to the issue now of regaining trust, if you will, in the nuclear community, but it's not just the nuclear community, it's all communities. You can play this little game, by the way, with yourself. Ask yourself who you trust and why you trust them. And I bet you'll come back to these three things, that the industry and all industries who want to find a way of getting acceptance in these very complicated, controversial, long-standing issues have got to put trust building as an important factor in their decision-making process.
Great. So let's turn to the fuel cycle and fuel storage. A question, What should be done to ensure continuous and reliable cooling of spent fuel in case of natural phenomena or sabotages, bombs, plane crashes? We had another question about uranium. You know, should we be thinking about, is thorium safer? Should we be moving towards alternative fuel cycles where we would be recycling waste? Another person asked, don't the French recycle waste? So I guess this is the fuel cycle. What do we know and what should be done?
I'll dive into that set of questions as well. One of the important lessons from Fukushima is that it was the reactors that in the end did cause the most substantive problems with respect to safety. And this is something we've known from some time is the potential, because when a reactor shuts down, it has a very large inventory of short-lived radioactive material, which means large amounts of heat generation and large inventories that could be released. That said, the spent fuel pools also create a set of hazards if they should drain. I think that the most surprising thing that we learned from Fukushima was the simple fact that there was not level instrumentation available to measure how much water was in the pools. It was assumed that operators could get access. This leaves us in a position of not having yet a clear understanding of what the safety issues are associated with those specific pools. But my expectation is that we're going to be looking at options to accelerate the transfer of spent fuel out of such pools and to have arrangements for fuel which can be better cooled even if you lose water inventory. Then, actually, I think when it comes to the question of longer-term safety of spent fuel, in particular disposal, Tom Isaacs actually is perhaps a better expert on that area.
I'll certainly take it on. So I mentioned this sort of the circumstance in the U.S. today. Today there is no permanent facility for the disposal of spent nuclear fuel or the resulting high-level weight if you reprocess it anywhere in the world. There's still no facility. However, I think most people would agree that the Scandinavians are in the lead here, and there's a lot of confidence that the Finns and the Swedes will have operating nuclear repositories probably within a decade. And it's very instructive to look at the cases and ask yourself why they're being successful, and there's lots of reasons for it. I'll give you a couple in a moment, but I think it's important to understand that eventually, whether you reprocess or not, there will be high-level wastes, either in the spent fuel or in the residue, if you reprocess it, that will be hazardous for very, very long periods of time. And the good news is we know how to store this waste safely for decades, maybe even a century or more. The bad news is that's not long enough. We need to be able to dispose of this waste permanently, because most people believe that for the length of time that this waste will be hazardous, which is many, many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, we can't rely on active administrative control. So we need to find a way to dispose of it. The way to do that, in most people's minds, is to find a stable, deep geologic formation that has been there for millions of years, shows great promise of being there for millions more, drill a hole down in there. The good news about nuclear is relative to other things, because the energy is so incredibly concentrated, the amount of waste produced, while not inconsequential, is not staggering in size. You can imagine putting a facility with maybe a couple hundred acres on the surface and maybe a couple thousand acres underneath and drilling tunnels underneath in the solid rock that you choose to dispose of it in, and that would take care of the waste for our country. So it's not an overwhelming size issue in that regard. There are large scientific and technical challenges to demonstrating, as I mentioned, that we found a suitable place, that it has all the characteristics that we want, that we know how to package the waste, we know how to bring it from the utilities and put it in appropriate circumstances, packages, and so forth, and put it in the ground, and that it's going to stay there. That scientific and technical challenge is almost beyond that. It's almost a spiritual issue as to whether or not you believe that we know what's going to happen 100,000 years from now, and spending all this money now is going to somehow help save the planet. I mean, that's imponderable in my mind. So that's one issue. The second issue is, you know, it's the siting issue. Everything has to be somewhere. And when you start saying, and by the way, we'd like you to be the host for this facility, people are often taken aback. Not always. You know, I often say we don't. This is not a beauty contest. It's not. You don't need a popular vote. You need some place where people see it as they're in their best interest and in the future vision of their community to accept this. And we actually have one in this country. There's a facility called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico, which has been open for a decade. It doesn't dispose of high-level waste. It disposes of something called transuranic waste, which are wastes that have components that are going to last for very, very long periods of time, many thousands of years, but they're not heat-bearing like the spent fuel is. And that facility has been welcomed by the community. It's, in some senses, saved that community economically. They were a mining community that went bust in some senses. And that synergy of trust building that I mentioned earlier, the interaction between the government and the national laboratories and the companies and the local government and the populace just started to resonate. And those people in Carlsbad now are saying, you know something, we'll take more. We like this. And so there is great opportunity if we try to run our programs right. And this is where we can learn a lot from places like Finland and Sweden and Canada, where they have taken this more adaptive approach, this more engaged approach, where we can have optimism, I believe, and the Blue Ribbon Commission is moving down this road to try and say there's another way of engaging in this country. And it's not the finger of the government from Washington, D.C. coming down and saying, we've picked you whether you like it or not. It's a much more organic process that says, what can we do to make your vision come true? And so I think there's lots of reasons for optimism. It won't happen easily. It won't happen surely. It won't happen cheaply. It won't happen quickly. But I do believe there's reasons to believe that it can indeed happen.
Thanks. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the policy landscape. So many questions were really focused on U.S. nuclear policy. So what are the subsidies that nuclear power receives, and how does this compare to what renewables receive in the U.S.? I guess weaved in with this is the limited liability insurance. I think the person asked this question didn't mention Price Anderson, but how big of a part of this subsidy is this risk component? And then I guess so the first question is, the first set of questions is kind of, well, what are we doing? What are we doing to subsidize nuclear or the alternatives? And then what should we be doing? What would it take to make nuclear plants an attractive financial investment in the future? And I guess the risk of getting this too political, what's going on with the current administration? Has Dr. Chu helped develop nuclear policies during his tenure? So that's a lot to chew on, but.
Was that an intended pun?
let me go ahead and start in on this set of questions. With respect to subsidies, of course, one wants to try to identify those that are associated with external costs and those that are explicit subsidies as well. In general, when we look at the external costs of different energy sources, what we find is that the external costs for fossil fuels are large. That is, the external costs are comparable to the cost of generation, which means that if you're looking at socially optimal consumption, that's a large subsidy because those costs are not internalized. And a lot of that comes from the carbon emissions, but it also comes from the air pollution and the public health problems, environmental damage. When you look at the non-fossil technologies, both nuclear and renewables, the studies, even when you include safety and accidents such as Fukushima, tend to show that the external costs are relatively small, a fraction, a few tenths of a cent per kilowatt hour main, perhaps, which means that while they're not zero, you're probably not making incorrect decisions as to how much you're consuming. On top of that, we have a set of explicit subsidies that include, well, the lack of a carbon tax really is that a part of that external one. But beyond that, we do a number of things to subsidize. So we have a 1.9 cent per kilowatt hour subsidy for renewable sources. There's the set of loan guarantees. You have a variety of different other mechanisms for subsidizing those fuel sources. And then, of course, things such as portfolio standards, which mandate the use of a technology, actually, in effect, are also a subsidy. On the nuclear side, if we look at those sorts of explicit subsidies, currently what we're seeing is efforts to put in place mechanisms like loan guarantees. And the interesting question is whether those are going to end up mitigating against just first mover type of costs, which are legitimate to subsidize, or whether you'll have to have ongoing subsidies after you've built the first few plants. And the interesting point about nuclear plants is that when you look at the cost of the materials required to build a plant, you add up the steel, the concrete, copper, aluminum, everything else, and then look at what it costs to procure the raw materials, the commodity costs, you reach the conclusion that it'll total up to somewhere around $40 a kilowatt out of the $4,000 per kilowatt that vendors will currently charge you to build a plant, which means that there's about 99% of what you're paying for in a nuclear plant is added value. And one of the big questions is, why is it 99% and not something substantively smaller? We won't know that for several years, because it won't be until we've gained experience with initial construction in the United States that we'll determine whether we can build these plants, new plants, on schedule and on budget.
Okay. Any?
I think that the issue of what nuclear costs really depends on what you think about the insurance that they don't have to buy. Okay, so I think that's really the heart of the problem, is that there's just not a level playing field when it comes to that, and there's not a level playing field for when it comes to the cost and who's paying the cost and who's guaranteeing the cost. So if you take those things aside, this is an important discussion to have about technology, but I think what we need is a recognition that the story, and I think the Mr. Isaac's point about the trust is part of what we're dealing with here. The whole response from the people in Japan, and including some of our own regulators, has been simply not adequate in terms of being honest and forthcoming about what we're facing and what these risks are. So I think it is necessary to confront the upside of nuclear power and to figure out a way to make it work if we can, because there are alternatives that aren't available in every part of the world and every part of this country even. So it's not a matter of taking it on or off the table. It's really a question of how does it fit and how do we put it in perspective, particularly when we have such an abundance of safer, better, cleaner, easier things that we can do. And to me, that's the problem with the administration's policy up to now, and certainly with the orientation of the Congress, and then there is all the information and mythology of the Internet to contend with. And if you look at what's actual economic and technological fact, we have much, much work to do to make this an acceptable path for us to go down. And while we're thinking about all that and working on all this, as we must, and we're blessed to have talent in this country that can manage these questions and contribute what they can, but we've neglected the alternatives and thought of them as a sideshow, sort of a little green side salad on the plate with the fossil fuel and the nuclear. And it needs to be more than that, because it's simpler. It's much more forgiving, and it's much more prone to the opportunities of cost reduction and technology improvement in these fundamental ways. And I think what's really been lacking is an appreciation, both with respect, and I very much agree with the comment about external costs of coal, but nobody's going to be building a lot of coal plants without some guarantees also. There's going to have to be a better understanding of the costs and the impacts of coal from a financial standpoint, because we may not have a carbon tax in this immediate future, but at some point we're going to have to figure out the need to pay for energy infrastructure, and a carbon tax is going to be seen as a logical way to do that, even if we call it something else.
Just a quick addition. I think it's important to look at this problem globally as well as locally. China today, in addition to building far more nuclear power plants than any other country in the world, I think the latest I saw is their plans are solid for 60. And every time they decide, they raise that number. They're like the U.S. was in the 50s here. You know, the money is not an object. In spite of the fact that they're doing that, they're opening a commercial size coal-fired plant every other day. And that's not clean coal. China needs everything.
and they understand that they need everything because they have a huge population and they are riding a economic rocket for the moment anyway. And so when we talk about the future, you know, the environment, the consequences doesn't stop at our national borders. That, you know, whether it's radioactivity or environmental pollution or greenhouse gases, it's an environmental global issue. And we're seeing this connectivity more and more. And so it's very important for us not to play this as a zero-sum game, somehow that I want to win. And the way I win is by convincing you that I want more fossil fuel than nuclear, or I want more solar than gas. That's the wrong game. It's the wrong mental mindset. We have to come up with a, I hate to use this word, it's overused, sustainable approach that will meet both our local needs, serve as, in a sense, leadership, and I very much agree with the comments about California often being a leader in innovation, but also recognize the hard facts of the fact that there are today a third of this planet that have no access whatsoever to electricity. Those people want and deserve an opportunity to come out of that situation, and we ought to be helping. And to help, it's going to take that whole basket, and it's going to take the meat and the potatoes and the salad and a big honkin' dessert in order for us to be successful here.
Thank you. One more question on nuclear policy before we turn to alternatives. I recently saw an article discussing the building projections for new nuclear power facilities. Virtually all of them are located east of the Mississippi and none in the west. Is there a reason for this?
That's correct. The majority of the combined construction operating licenses that have been issued are in the southeast. And in fact, the majority of nuclear plants operating today are in the east, not in the west. And that would actually be you can easily explain that if you look at how coal is distributed and how hydro capacity is distributed across the country. So that's logical also that what we're seeing with the initial new construction is that it's going to be dominantly focused in the southeast and in potentially in Texas as well. The new plants that are the furthest along in the United States are four new Westinghouse AP1000 units that will be built at the Vogtle site and at the Summer site. Early site preparation is underway for those plants. They do happen to be U.S. designed reactors that feature passive safety systems. So from the perspective of what we're learning from Fukushima, those characteristics and the capability to shut down and remove heat without the need for any electrical power is clearly a beneficial attribute. But the other interesting characteristic of the design of these plants is that the construction occurs in factories rather than at the site. The structures are constructed out of steel plates instead of using conventional reinforcing bar and concrete. And the steel structures are prefabricated in factories. There's a factory operating in China that is building these structures for units that are being built in China. The one that will work in the United States is being built at Lake Charles, Louisiana. And it's very similar technology to how we build ships now, which is they're not built in a dry dock anymore. They're assembled there. And then literally large sections of the building are assembled on site, lifted into place, and concrete is poured into between the plates, and you have a reactor. What we're very interested in finding out is what are the implications of this in terms of affecting construction cost and schedule. It could be transformative, but we just don't know until we've built the first couple of these plants.
Okay, so let's turn to alternatives and get John in here more. A number of questions along these lines. What has the potential to be the next go-to source of energy for the world? I know you talked about this a bit, but you talked about geothermal. We'd love to push you more on these specifics. Maybe, and this is one, and I can add on to this. Someone asked, if fusion energy is around the corner, why bother with new plants as currently designed? I guess How do we think about the fact that that the next energy source, we may not even know what it is yet, may not be around yet?
Well, I only know what I know, so I'll leave the fusion question to the experts. I think that what we know is that the natural environment provides an abundant source of energy if we're clever in adapting to its use. We've taken for granted the amount of energy that we use in this country as if it's an entitlement and if it's necessary. And if the Chinese use the same amount of oil per person as we do at some point, or even half that amount, it's game over. Okay, so we don't have the ability to sustain this level of energy consumption and this poor level of energy efficiency because it's just simply too expensive. The trouble is that the cost is a future cost. And the cost of today's consumers is people don't want to pay higher gas prices, they don't want to pay higher electricity rates, you know, but wanting and having it ain't the same, okay? And at some point, we're going to have to decide, do we want to ignore the facts and evidence, or are we going to accept them and work towards them? So that's sort of my starting philosophy, and we have great ability to do a lot of good things better. We have an enormous amount of technology and talent in this country. In the Midwest, all of the machine tools and die making capacity, we can make a lot of wind turbines and a lot of solar panels. And I think that the thing about it is we have to think about costs and value differently than we have up to now. And if we think about those things differently, I think we'll get to better answers. In terms of what the mix is, again, we look around us. We look at our waste, our animal waste, our human waste. We look at the sun and the way we interact with our buildings. And we look at the wind and the geothermal. And not everybody has the same mix of resources. So that's why these questions are largely regional. But there has been some very significant work underway in the Department of Energy with the 2050 time frame in mind that suggests that the country could get a very, very large fraction of its total energy supply from a renewable-based system. And I think the question isn't whether we can get it all from that or what the precise mix is. What we know about these technologies is that you substitute labor and technology and capital for fuel. That's really the formula of building nuclear power as well as renewable technologies, and that requires us to think about how to value the money over the life of the plant and the life of the technology properly, and so we have to reorient our thinking to make the money realistic so that the technologies can be built. I think these are more political problems than they are technology problems, and that if we decide it's important enough, we can do amazing things.
So unfortunately, you only have time for one more question, and I'm going to use my moderator prerogative to kind of bring us back to how we started here. We're real close to Fukushima now, so it's hard to have perspective, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, well, how are we going to view Fukushima? Is this a giant shock, or is this a little bump in the road for U.S. energy policy?
I think that Fukushima will cause fundamental changes in how we view nuclear energy, and it will cause us to focus on changing the way that we build and operate reactors. I do think that it's interesting that what we're seeing now is that those new plant designs that have passive safety systems are moving forward into construction. The other projects that have been proposed for a variety of reasons are facing challenges. So if we go back to the time of the Three Mile Island accident, there's an interesting point about what was happening back then. Not only did we have an accident, but also the reliability of nuclear plants was abysmally low, particularly in the United States. The average capacity factor in the United States was down in the low 60th percentile, which means that on any given day of the week back in the 80s, a third of the plants in the country would be shut down for a variety of reasons, extended refueling outages, forced outages, and such. The response to TMI actually catalyzed systematic efforts to identify ways to reduce rates of human error, to improve equipment reliability, to incentivize a safety culture that encourages the reporting of problems and corrective actions for those problems. As an informed member of the public, one should not be distressed when you hear that nuclear power plants have problems, because you want them to be reported. What you don't want to hear about is problems that are being repeated, where the corrective actions are not effective. And in general, the reliability of plants has increased enormously. So today, its forced outage rate within the United States is less than 2%, which is a pretty impressive situation. But the big question today, then, is can you build new plants on schedule, on budget, that have sufficiently high level of safety that you have confidence? And I think that we'll be focused more on those questions, and we'll defer some of the issues about is there enough uranium, which we know for several decades is probably acceptable, and can we do something further to greatly reduce the amount of waste that reactors generate, a bit further, where we focus on this question of how do we build better reactors that have more intrinsic and transparent safety characteristics.
In August of last year at Stanford, we held a workshop that we called the Nuclear Game Changer Workshop. And it sprung from an idea that some of us had, that we tend to sit here in a situation like this here tonight and say, here's the way we project things are going to happen in the future. Here's the most likely course, and maybe we're uncertain this direction, maybe we're a little optimistic, a little pessimistic. And maybe that's not the way the world works. And so we postulated the fact that suppose we were in the year 2060 and we were holding a conference on the last 50 years of nuclear power. Would those people in 2060 have looked back and said, God, those guys in 2010 certainly were smart. They got it exactly right. Not much of unexpected nature happened. No. It's very likely that we would have had surprises. And we talked about a major nuclear accident, and unfortunately, less than a year later, we had that game-changing, potentially nuclear accident occur. Stephen Jay Gould, a late professor from Harvard, talked about something called punctuated equilibrium, which is that basically the world kind of moves along in a certain way, and then something happens, and all of a sudden the world changes. And then you move along again until something happens. 9/11, I think, would be a classic example of a major game changer. It changed our psyche, it changed our spending habits, it changed our lifestyles, it changed a lot. If we now look to the year 2061, and we're going to hold that meeting and say, what happened in the last 50 years? My own sense, and this is a speculative thing, is that Fukushima is not going to be a major game changer. I think it will be viewed as another example of both the promise and the peril of the technology and the obligation to do the things that Per Petersen just talked about. But I don't personally think it's going to change the trajectory as much as some other things might. It might be the introduction in fundamental ways of both renewables or carbon taxes or fusion. You mentioned fusion. There's a very exciting future potential for fusion. It may not be realized, but at the laboratory where I work, we have something called the National Ignition Facility. It was built to simulate nuclear weapons, because we don't test nuclear weapons anymore. That's a good thing. But we need to make sure that the ones we have stay safe and reliable. So we built a fusion device to simulate a nuclear weapons test. But that same facility can also be used for energy research. And pretty soon, people at the lab are pretty confident that we will achieve something that's never been achieved before. It's called ignition, which means that you finally get to the place where you put less energy in to create the fusion experiment, and you get more energy out. And now you've got what's called gain. You're actually creating energy. And if we were to get to the place where we started to have a concerted effort toward fusion, there's lots of skeptics out there, there's lots of different technologies out there. This one is going to achieve ignition, I'm fairly confident, is going to offer an opportunity to change the game. We may not take advantage of it. We may not be successful. It is in the romantic stage that I talked about earlier. But the country has an opportunity, if it decides to get behind some of these very exciting opportunities here and decide whether it wants to get at the cutting edge of these kinds of technologies, because in lots of senses, I would say with regard to the nuclear one, the thing I worry about the most is we are losing our competitive edge, and we are losing not only the ability to shape our own future, but to make sure that the rest of the world acts responsibly as well.
My view is that Fukushima is a crossroads that is probably a combination of things. I think it's a wake-up call for the nuclear industry and its regulators that business as usual is not going to be satisfactory, and a much, much higher level of scrutiny and transparency is going to be required. And I think that may be something that could save the future of nuclear power, that they had to stop pretending and stop making things up about how safe things were and actually ensure the safety and earn the trust that is required for it to go forward. I also think, though, that the impact of Japan and Europe taking a very much harder look at the existing technology and the existing plants will have some impact in the U.S. And I think one of the things I hope happens is that we don't just focus on trying to imagine a nuclear revival or a renaissance, but focus on solving the fundamental underlying problems that the technology has in a research sense, and seeing, rather than deploying lots of today's technology plants, I think the emphasis and the support needs to be given to the university and the commercial research community, much as was done on a smaller scale for renewables. The technologies were kept alive through the national labs and through some early deployments. I think that also the comment about the fusion technology, things that we don't know about producing energy, we're likely to have lots of that come about. I think that's true also, though, with renewable technologies and with efficiency. And if you look at the innovations and the changes in the digital technologies and the opportunities for knitting smart technologies together between cars and grid and homes and buildings, and also to make the cost and the deployment of renewable technologies more predictable. One of the problems that we face, we've had our own romantic period and our own periods of great darkness in the renewable industry. And the most important thing is that we have sustained and orderly development of these technologies and deploy them and learn from that deployment, much as we've learned from the deployment of the other technologies. I just would like to see a more central recognition. And I think Fukushima will in some ways help us accomplish that, to put in perspective the costs, the risks, and the values of the technologies that are currently underutilized compared to their potential. And hopefully we'll end up with a safer, saner, sustainable world with all of the technologies being priced and cost at their true cost, so there's no hiding the ball about that. But at the same time that we solve problems, we don't go through rapid swings of yes or no or anti and pro, but to actually work on solving problems and making a logical, common sense energy portfolio that protects the interests of our children and our grandchildren.
Thanks, John. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council and the Marines Memorial Association, please join me in thanking Thomas Isaacs, Per Peterson, and John White for providing us with their thoughts and insights tonight.